Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Please continue with your lunch, but it might be appropriate to start now. We have a large luncheon audience, and I'd like to express my appreciation to Kellogg Center for another very excellent lunch and a very tasty dessert. And I mention tasty dessert because I have a sweet tooth, but I did promise my wife that I'd lay off the dessert in order that I would be able to have two desserts after I introduce Maynard Jackson, or after he's presented, rather. Let me begin by welcoming each and every one of you to the Urban Forum sponsored by the College of Urban Development. I'd like to add, too, that a number of colleges on the campus did assist in co-sponsoring the luncheon effort. And I'd like to acknowledge the college, each college, and each dean very briefly. It's Dean Goldhammer here from Dean of the College of Education, Dean Goldhammer. I see Dr. Don Nickerson, his representative, is here. Please stand, Don. Give Don a hand. Dr. Nickerson directs the graduate admissions in the College of Education. Dean Sullivan, Arts and Letters, is here. Dean Sullivan? Dean Sullivan? Thank you. Dean Lewis of the College of Business is here. Dean Lewis? Dean Lewis Lund of the College of Human Ecology could not be with us today. Dean Banks of James Madison College is here somewhere. Give him a hand. I'd like to also take just a very brief second and introduce the individuals who play a very key and a very important role in operating and maintaining the College of Urban Development. Dr. Jack Bain. Did Jack make it this afternoon? Jack Bain was at a coffee this past Saturday evening at Dr. John Porter's home and unfortunately dumped a pot of coffee in his lap. So he's been suffering a little pain this afternoon, so the last day or so. And I'm not a physician, but I understand the pain is more specific than general. Dr. Bain is chairman of the Department of Racial and Ethnic Studies. I didn't mean to be funny at all. Dr. Eric Winston, Assistant Dean for Student Services, Dr. Winston. Dr. Lawrence Lazat, Chairman of Urban and Metropolitan Studies, Dr. Lazat in the back. And Dr. Maxie Jackson, Director of the Center for Urban Affairs. I'd like to add, too, that there are very important people here who assist our city in functioning, namely in the East Lansing and in the Lansing area. And I'd like to begin by introducing Councilwoman Thelma Evans from East Lansing. Councilman Joel Ferguson of Lansing. Mayor Brookover, the mayor of East Lansing and a very good friend of mine. Mayor Brookover. And I'd like to introduce the man who was the mayor of the town when I came here in 1960, I believe, Gordon Thomas, professor of communications and mayor, former mayor of East Lansing. Distinguished economist and former president, Walter Adams. One cannot think of entertainment in this country without considering very seriously Motown Corporation. And I would like to introduce a very prominent person in that corporation, the Senior Vice President, Mrs. Esther Edwards. Very close friends of Michigan State University and very close friends of the College of Urban Development. Senator Earl Nelson, please stand. And Representative Lynn John Dahl. I attended a dinner here at Michigan State University last week, as a matter of fact, in this very room. It was an honors assembly in which outstanding students and faculty members at the university were honored. 17 university students were initiated into Phi Kappa Phi, the honorary academic Greek letter organization. And one of our majors, Jill Beeling, a major in urban and metropolitan studies, an outstanding student with a very high overall grade point average, was initiated into that honorary Greek letter organization. I'd like to ask Jill to be stand and to be acknowledged. Jill Beeling. She's in the back. And I'd like to introduce my wife, Letty Green, who's sitting here. My comments will be brief in order that our distinguished guests can be introduced. But I would like to suggest that poverty, a growing rate of unemployment, and Michigan has been heavily hit by unemployment, Detroit being a very strong example, dilapidated housing, have caused many individuals to give up hope for our cities. Admittedly, the following data might support that point of view. More than 25 million people in the United States have less than an adequate income. More than 25% of the same individuals live in urban communities. The unemployment rate in urban core areas is double that of the general population. And recent data indicates that on the east side of Detroit last week, the unemployment rate for young men between the ages of 18 and 30 is approaching 60%. Notwithstanding these facts, I yet believe that there is great hope for urban America. One important reason why I believe there is hope for our cities is the new urban leadership which has appeared in recent years. Men such as Maynard Jackson and Coleman Young are bringing experience and problem-solving dedication to large cities such as Atlanta and Detroit. Another hope I see for our cities is in our young people, many of whom are concerned about the plight of urban citizens and poor people everywhere, and willing to do something at the same time to help American people. The College of Urban Development is helping these young people direct their enthusiasm and energy into developing skills and preparing for careers in urban-related professions such as health services, education, housing, transportation, and policy making to help alleviate the difficulties which confront the poor in our cities. Our college, the College of Urban Development, has had 7 graduates. 5 are employed in professional careers, 2 are in graduate school at the moment, and of the approximately 15 June 1975 graduates, 3 have applied to law school, 1 to graduate school at MIT, 2 to graduate programs here at Michigan State University, and employment is being determined for the rest. As a matter of fact, Maynard Jackson isn't aware of the fact that part of the condition of him being here today is to guarantee us employment for at least 5 of our graduates in June. I might add, too, that we have 2 student interns in the city of Atlanta at the moment, one working with city government, and the other student working with the Atlanta Public School System. We're also committed to the fact in our college that our job does not end when the formal training of our students ceases. We're committed to the notion of finding each and every graduate a full-time professional career. So, Mayor Jackson, as I've said to Mayor Young in Detroit, we're looking for adequate, strong, positive careers for our students in urban communities throughout the country. I might add, too, that the faculty of the College of Urban Development is also very unique. We have on our faculty 4 psychologists, 2 sociologists, 1 social worker, 1 political scientist, 1 lawyer, a graduate of the University of Michigan's Law School, and we'll forgive him for that, two economists, a historian, an anthropologist, and a medical doctor, a very interdisciplinary faculty. All of these individuals are working together to find effective ways to cope with urban problems and to teach our students problem-solving strategies. The Urban Lecture Forum series is a very important part of the college experience. The forum brings to the MSU campus outstanding individuals who are knowledgeable about the needs of those in our cities and surrounding communities. These experts share their knowledge with those in the university and outside communities who are concerned about the status of urban residents. During the current year, we've had Professor Jack Forbes, the outstanding anthropologist from California, Marion Wright Elderman from the Children's Defense League in Boston and Washington, and Arthur Ashe, the outstanding tennis player who achieved a very great victory on yesterday, and we're pleased about that. And today we have Maynard Jackson of Atlanta, Georgia. Today I'm happy to present to you a well-known member of the university community. He has been very instrumental in facilitating Michigan State University's total urban thrust. With the support of the university community, the MSU Board of Trustees, and his personal leadership, a major step was taken in converting the 4.5-year Center for Urban Affairs into a 4-year degree-granting undergraduate program. President Clifton R. Wharton, Jr. is a graduate of Harvard University, John Hopkins University School of International Studies, and the University of Chicago. He has demonstrated throughout his career resourcefulness and competence as an economist, a consultant in economic development and foreign affairs, a writer, and an educator, and I might add, a knowledgeable person about sports. With that note, it's my pleasure to present to you President Clifton Wharton.
Thank you very much, Dean Green. Distinguished members of the state legislature, state government, elected municipal official, and friends. It's a very great pleasure for me to be with you here today, especially to introduce today's speaker, the Honorable Maynard Holbrook Jackson, the mayor of the city of Atlanta. It's particularly a pleasure for me to introduce him because I had the distinct pleasure of being present on a different occasion in Atlanta when Mayor Jackson at that time was the deputy mayor of Atlanta, and I was about to give a speech in Atlanta. Mayor Jackson has a marvelous sense of humor, and I distinctly recall on that occasion as he was welcoming an extremely large national assembly of black physicians from all over the United States, that he averred to the fact that at that time as deputy mayor, the mayor of Atlanta was a Mr. Mazzell who was of the Jewish faith. And he pointed out that obviously with a Jewish mayor and a black deputy mayor, that the city of Atlanta was integrated, and he welcomed us to the city which served kosher chitlins. And I was very struck by his sense of humor. I was also tremendously impressed with, as you undoubtedly have been and will be, with Mayor Jackson's girth. He's a very large man in the physical sense, and I heard today, in this day of allegation and rumor, that it was rumored that in view of the fact that we are in desperate need for an improvement in our football program, that we were trying to recruit Mayor Jackson as a guard. Now, I want to assure you that he did play football for Morehouse for 1 year. It is true that he does have, I believe, at least 3 more years of eligibility. But it is not true, as far as I have been able to determine as yet, that this particular luncheon constitutes a form of illegal recruiting. I say that because he has several more years to go in his present term. Seriously, though, I would like to share with you a few facts about our distinguished speaker. Mr. Jackson was born in Dallas, Texas, and at the age of 7, he moved to Atlanta, where he attended public schools and quickly distinguished himself as an outstanding student. A Ford Foundation early admission scholar, he entered Morehouse at the amazing age of 14 years of age. He took his BA in political science at the age of 18, and later earned the degree of Juris Doctor cum laude from North Carolina Central University. After leaving North Carolina Central University, Mayor Jackson first worked as a general attorney for the Atlanta region of the National Labor Relations Board. Afterward, he represented low-income persons for the Emory Community Legal Services Center, managed and directed community relations for the Emory Neighborhood Law Office, and became senior partner in the law firm of Jackson, Patterson, and Parks. In January 1970, he became Atlanta's vice mayor and president of the Board of Aldermen, positions he held until January 1974, when he assumed the mayorship of the city. As the first black mayor of a modern metropolitan center in the South, Maynard Jackson has worked diligently to further responsible urban government in a city long regarded as a symbol of progress and culture for an entire region. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm happy to yield the rostrum to a distinguished public servant, a great black, a great American, and a great mayor, Mayor Maynard Holbrook Jackson.
Thank you, Dr. Horton. I don't deserve it all, but like the guy was given a glowing introduction, upon rising, he said, "Let us pray." He said, "Dear Lord, please forgive the man for his exaggerations, and please forgive me for enjoying them so much." Mayor Brookover, other distinguished elected officials, Dr. Horton, Dr. Green, ladies and gentlemen, I'm delighted to be with you at Michigan State University, especially under the aegis of the College of Urban Development, and especially because the dean is Bob Green, a man whose contribution to America in so many ways is so well known, whose allegiance, without any exception, to nonviolent social change is so well known and so well documented that it never can be questioned, whose capacity to lead and to administer the affairs of this college, of course, are well substantiated. A young man who has walked the roads and who has been through the cauldron, the testing by fire, about which so many of us talk, but very few have had the chance to experience. And so when Bob Green called me, although it is rare for me to be out of my city, except on direct city business on a weekday, I told him, yes, I'd be more than happy to come, and I'm honored by the invitation. Your president, of course, is known internationally and admired, respected deeply, and I have known the name of my family of Wharton for an awfully long time. I think there's a business school named after you, Mr. President. At least, isn't that what you told me? But you've got a great president here, and I'm very pleased to be with you and to bring you greetings from what we think is the greatest city in this country, with the possible exception of East Lansing and Lansing. Atlanta, Georgia. You know Atlanta because if you have flown anywhere, you have been to Atlanta. Second busiest airport in the world, second behind O'Hare. We're going to pass O'Hare in 84. And if you haven't been there yet, and if you pass on, you can change your chariots at Hartsfield. Bring your greetings from a city which saw the ironic spectacle of kids in public schools taking up nickels and dimes to bring kids from Boston schools to Atlanta to see how integration and busing work. Also bring you greetings from a city which believes that communications or communicating is the basis for effective government as much as anything else. Interracial communicating, that communication is critical to, first of all, the formulation of programs, and secondly, the execution successfully of those programs. And that's pretty tough to do these days. It's tough to do any time, I guess, but especially now, when anxieties are so acute for so many different reasons. But communicating is important, and that's what I hope we can do some today. When I finish my remarks, I understand we'll have time for questions and answers. Hope I'll have the answers. I'm sure you'll have the questions. But I think of the story of, when I think of communicating, of the story of the guy who was having some marital difficulties and with his wife. And of a very intimate nature. You understand what I mean. In the South, we try to be delicate about these matters. He went to his doctor to seek advice, and the doctor advised him to take this prescription for vitamins and to run 10 miles a day and call him at the end of 7 days. 7 days passed, the man called his physician back, and then the doctor said, "How are you?" He said, "I'm doing much better." He said, "I feel a bit tired from all the running, but I have taken the vitamin pills and so forth." The doctor said, "Fine, now how are you and your wife getting along?" He said, "I don't know, I'm 70 miles from home." And when I heard Dr. Horton commenting how somebody made the tactical error of cleaning the sidewalk in front of his home before cleaning other sidewalks around Michigan State, and how, you know, this plagues all public officials, elected and otherwise, you've got to be awfully careful that people don't think you're trying to take advantage of your position, which of course he was not doing. It was unknown to him that it was done. But when you're in the public eye, you can be so often misunderstood. It's very important to try to make yourself clear. I think now the Anglican Archbishop, who had enjoyed a meteoric rise in the church, very outspoken, so much so that he sometimes opened his mouth just long enough to change feet, who had never been to America and was en route to New York for his first American visit, when the aide to the Archbishop cautioned him, "Please, whatever you do, don't offend the Americans." And he said, "I'll be very careful." Plane landed in New York and he got off the plane. The press rushed around him immediately, and right away the first question they asked was, "Archbishop, what do you think about all the prostitutes in New York City?" And he was cool. He said, "Are there any prostitutes in New York City?" And the next day when the headlines came out, they said upon his arrival in New York, the very first question the Archbishop asked was, "Are there any prostitutes in New York City?" So I hope we're going to be on a clearer wavelength today. The job of the urban public administrator perhaps is the most difficult and constantly demanding of any job in this country. In the best of times, the urban administrator's job comes complete with all of the pressures afforded any top executive. But in 1975, it comes with the added burden of a grim national economic picture and the increasingly vocal input of various citizen groups just learning the importance of their political clout. Our national economic picture is not one that raises our hopes for the 1975 economy. Although we are told we're about to turn the economic corner, most of us are wondering seriously what the devil is around that corner. Many of us are becoming increasingly apprehensive about what may be around that corner. In fact, our admitted national unemployment rate is at the 8.9% mark, which means, therefore, that if the Intergovernmental Counter-Cyclical Assistance Act of 1975, for which Coleman Young and Mayor Beam and Alioto of San Francisco and many other mayors and I lobbied on Thursday in Washington, were to pass, we'd have $5 billion flowing to cities directly for operational expenses, and Mayor Young would not have to be faced with the choice of having to lay off personnel. That general figure takes on an even more frightening reality when we realize that unemployment for blue-collar workers is now over 11%, over 13% nationally for blacks and other non-white minorities, and over 20% nationally for teenagers. Job gains for women and minorities that are the result of years of struggle are in very real danger, as we know, of being completely wiped out by layoffs and by cutbacks. These unemployment figures are even more serious in the face of continuing inflation. The working men and women who had provided comfortable middle income lives for their families now are faced with the specter of welfare as their unemployment benefits run out, and their lovingly cultivated nest eggs are drained by the rising costs of everything from food to electricity. And they have no background of having to scuffle. We find for the first time that hunger is a problem for thousands of our citizens who never faced the problem before. They don't have the experience with cutting corners and making do that has sustained poor people for centuries. We see the newly hungry come in anger and acute frustration to receive food giveaways and to come to local agencies that are set up to help in other ways. And even these agencies, already overburdened by cutbacks in federal money for social programs, $16 billion cut by Ford from social programs, cannot handle the rapidly increasing numbers of people who must be helped. We can go on and talk about the Triton and the B-1, but not about social programs. In a nation where 80% of the people live on 2% of the land, something is awfully screwed up. Now, this frustration adds another dimension to the problem of crime in our cities. As times get harder, we can see the rising unemployment figures mirrored in rising crime rates. Faced with unpaid bills, empty refrigerators, and crying hungry children, desperation turns to determination. As illegal as it may be, regrettably, and I do regret it, and the phrase, by any means necessary, takes on new meaning to people who never would have broken the law if they had seen a remote possibility of help available to them. No excuse for breaking the law. No excuse. But here's an explanation of why it's happening. So our economic situation is not an encouraging one, but it is not our only problem either. In the face of increasing economic uncertainty, Americans look to their government for answers. And although those of us in public service are struggling to find new, workable, creative solutions, we have no easy answers. Unfortunately, we have no ready panaceas to propose to our worried constituents on the local level. The widespread governmental uncertainty, especially on the federal level, is causing an alarming drop of confidence among Americans of all economic strata. No level of government, from the local level to the White House, receives the automatic support and respect that was given by some Americans without question just a few short years ago. Citizens no longer are willing to put their lives in their hands or in the hands of their government, and accept the decisions of the government without question, even to the extent that it was done recently. But I find increasing evidence that this lack of blind faith, this growing skepticism, is being channeled in some ways into positive directions. The rising expectations of our people, urban people, and their willingness to translate these expectations into concrete and specific demands is giving rise to a new kind of citizen involvement in government. This citizen involvement is being forged in the fires of practical political experience. And therefore, we are seeing now the creation of a new urban lobbyists whose interests are not money and power for the sake of manipulation and control, but power to control their own lives and the things that affect the quality of their lives, from highway construction to public schools. We find highly articulate and committed and deeply informed civic organizations joining together to work with their government when we are right and to give us holy hell when we are wrong, and well they should. These groups give, or help to give a voice rather, to blacks and to women and to minorities traditionally denied a place in the halls of government. I'm convinced, ladies and gentlemen, that this kind of citizen involvement is a sine qua non of government. And the government can overcome increasing citizen apathy and alienation only with major citizen participation. New bonds must be established based on a legitimate community government dialogue with an effective demonstration of responsiveness. We've got to recognize a government can succeed only through the continued support and trust of the public. In my home city, Atlanta, we're making a conscious and conscientious effort to strengthen the existing mechanisms of citizen participation, and where necessary, and we found that that meant many places, to create new lines of communication. We have a new city charter effective January 7, 1974, when I became mayor. That created a radical change in our form of government, going from weak mayor board of aldermen form to strong mayor city council form with strict separation of powers. And this new charter contains one of the strongest commitments to community participation in comprehensive planning of any city in this country. Our citizen involvement ordinance passed by the city council on our basic drafting, which implements the new city charter, mandates public hearings and continual reevaluations of community needs during the creation and implementation of our city's 1, 5, and 15-year comprehensive development plans. We also have independent municipal agencies handling citizen problems and complaints. The Atlanta Community Relations Commission was established in 1966 and functions in the areas of housing and employment discrimination, police, community relations, and consumer affairs. My administration created the Office of Ombudsman in 1974 as an independent municipal agency handling citizen complaints concerning city services and abuses by government. Now, outside of these two highly structured citizen outreach programs, we have attempted to encourage our city's many neighborhood and civic organizations to become involved in all aspects of our city's planning process. Planning is one of the major contributions my administration is making and will make to Atlanta. In the period of my service as mayor, we have seen in Atlanta a growth in local community organizations from 160 to 235, a sign of community acceptance of our challenge to get involved. We have worked closely and successfully with several of these neighborhood organizations to defeat a proposed highway whose right-of-way already had been secured and cleared, which would have destroyed several of our most viable and productive in-town neighborhoods. We now have 10 simultaneously reviving neighborhoods in our city. Middle-income, younger, well-educated whites are coming back to Atlanta in significant numbers, because it's a better place to live than outside of Atlanta. But you cannot tell somebody come and live in the city and then run a highway through their bathroom. There's something inconsistent about that. And so the commitment of this administration is to make sure that we protect and improve our present in-town neighborhoods. And we're doing that. And the battle was rough, rugged, and believe me, bitter at times. But the result is that on Friday night, although everybody in the world knows that in urban America, nobody comes downtown at night, we all know that, we had, at the end of Mayor's Day for the Arts, a 12-hour, 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. thing of arts in the streets of Atlanta, closing off downtown streets in the parks, Atlanta Symphony, jazz, gospel, Shakespeare, marionettes, pantomime, 200 and some odd artists in the streets of the city with their booths set up, performing the work they perform, nothing for sale, demonstrating only. All over the place, the city was jumping, 8,000 people in Central City Park, 9 o'clock Friday night until 11:30 at night, listening to music of all kinds, while in the next park away, several hundred more, 60% white. And so for those who say that, you know, folks won't come downtown, and it's not true. If there's something to bring them there, they'll be there. Now, outside of the structured programs for citizen outreach that I've already mentioned, we have attempted to encourage our city's many neighborhood and civic organizations to become involved in a more structured sort of way by virtue of an ordinance which we have prepared, which has now been adopted, that outlines by boundaries on which we have now agreed by vote 24 neighborhood planning units. And these make up the entire city of Atlanta. Each NPU, neighborhood planning unit, will have its own neighborhood planning committee. And these will feed into the city structure. They cannot mandate what happens in the neighborhoods, because the city council cannot delegate the power to vote to anybody else. That decision must be made there, rightfully should be made by the elected officials. But they will tell us what they want to see happen. They'll make the recommendations to become a part of the continual updating of our 1-5 and 15-year comprehensive development plans for the city of Atlanta. Structured, a part of city government. But despite all of this, of course, there are problems in that we face across this country now a cynicism on the part of many citizens who distrust governmental involvement in areas previously considered private, afraid of corruption by the powers that be. Some people prefer to work totally outside of government structures. This fear is increased when a fledgling civic association finds itself embroiled in a battle of wills with City Hall. We have tried to maximize credibility by never promising things we cannot deliver, by never painting a picture of any situation that is rosier than reality, and always by working with the citizens on their concerns rather than attempting to package them in neat bureaucratic boxes for delivery to them for their post-planning ratification. The Junior League said they wanted to get involved in Atlanta, so I met with the president, the past president, and the president-elect in my office. And they didn't really believe we were serious about it, because they've been offering for a long time to get involved. And I think some people in the past have kind of thought this was a nice little organization of nice ladies, comfortable, too comfortable, who weren't really serious. They're serious. Give them something to do, and we're going to give them hard work to do, and they're going to do it. People are begging to get involved. But we've got to level with them when we involve them and never deceive them as to what the facts are. Same goes for public housing tenants in our city. Highly structured, highly organized, and now by my appointment represented on the Atlanta Housing Authority. Who better knows the problems of public housing tenants than public housing tenants? So we're broadening the base of citizen participation. No longer will business and government run the city of Atlanta alone. But if anybody expects me to say we don't want business at the table, they're crazy. Business must be at the table. And that's been my approach. And I don't care how much paranoia I see in certain areas of the community about whether I'm getting too close to the business community. I can guarantee them there's more paranoia in the business community about how close I'm getting to the grassroots community. The name of the game is to keep business at the table, but also bring grassroots community to the table. Grassroots means, in Atlanta, low income, white and black, middle income, white and black, issue oriented. They sit at the table in Atlanta now, and so does business. And only by bringing all the groups together can the city function most effectively. Now, we also have become very familiar with two organizational phenomena: groups without spokespersons and spokespersons without groups. Now, the former, groups without spokespersons, is not a difficult phenomenon to handle. There's usually a member of the group willing and able to assume leadership with some encouragement from the rest of the group. But the latter, spokespersons without groups, is more complicated because we often find ourselves presented with an individual who claims to speak for a large and influential segment of his or her community, when in reality the leader is self-appointed, sometimes even abhorred, in his or her own district. We have found that in dealing with the groupless spokesperson, trusted community contacts and a healthy dose of skepticism are invaluable. Now, as the scale of government becomes increasingly complex in size and in responsibility, we must make greater efforts to be sure that our citizens do not feel alienated and powerless, aside from the fact that they don't feel that way. We've got to make sure that there is a continuing growing understanding of the need to accept and to encourage serious citizen participation on every level. In many instances, this is happening already, but too often we find government and citizens meeting only when there are crises, and thus confusion and hostility often result. We have to realize that criticism and feedback are essential to good government and can be channeled constructively into outlets for effective community participation. But as we become more open and more responsive to our citizens, we must also be aware of the tensions inherent in the development of new power relationships. We must not become so optimistic and enthusiastic that we don't recognize the dangers of poor communications and misunderstanding that are common in dealing with the complex subjects that concern us as we go about the business of organizing and running our lives. We have to be sensitive to the feelings of the old guard, who find that suddenly their power is not so great and that their voices are not the only ones being heard now around the bargaining table. We have to try to make them see also and the expansion of the long-standing coalition between business and government to include the grassroots community at every level does not signal the end of a long period of prosperity and plenty. No more idea about if you elect a black mayor, the city's going to go to hell. Most of the cities that have black mayors, with some notable exceptions, had already gone to hell under white leadership before black mayors were ever elected. Remember Newark? The great raid on the public treasury, the rape of Newark, and then they said, okay, you can have it. You got to admire Ken Gibson for hanging in there. In a city where In this city, a $20,000 house, you pay $2,000 in property taxes on that house. Ken Gibson could throw up his hands like some other folks have done and walk away too. But he has the guts to believe that he can try to rebuild something that was destroyed before he ever became mayor. So I think we can look at these developments at the dawn of a new day in which all the segments of our communities can have equal input into the decision-making process, to the enrichment of that process, and not to the destruction of it. We have to make it clear that all the decisions are no longer made on the golf courses of private clubs. Those decisions still will be ably and responsibly made. We have to encourage folks to understand that they have to continue their participation in the process of government, working with the other members of their community toward a more complete and a more humane town or city, where there is interchange among all economic and social levels. That's why we're going to develop now, and it took us 13 months to negotiate it out, on 78 acres of urban renewal land smack downtown Atlanta, around the Atlanta Civic Center, privately financed with a guaranteed minimum for low and moderate income of 25%, 3,000 units of housing. And from the outside, you won't be able to tell what's low income and what's middle income and what's upper income. Esplanades, parks, open spaces, daycare centers, early learning centers, office towers, hotels. It's called Bedford Pine, Bedford-Pine. It is significant as a development, but is more important as a precedent in planned economic mix in the city, smack downtown. Now, just as important as the other concerns we have mentioned, we have to ensure that the new power brokers don't become drunk with that power and use it to the detriment of the city. We must not allow irresponsible leaders of any color to misrepresent the needs of their communities and lead us toward undesirable goals for everybody. We have to make sure that the purpose of new ideas is to expand the participants in the decision-making process, not necessarily to exchange one group of self-styled decision makers for another. Now, that requires a two-way cooperation. If the old decision makers say to hell with it and goodbye, then there is no choice but to exchange the groups. The new power brokers become the decision makers, to the exclusion of the old, but by option of the old power brokers. That is not desirable. That is avoidable. And one of the great strengths of Atlanta is the pragmatism of its business community. There may be anxieties. Any change brings anxieties. But there's an overwhelming understanding of reality and the fact that we have a booming, blooming city. So we have to urge the community groups and civic organizations to expand their vision to include the entire city and not just their immediate concerns. It's a very difficult process, but it's required. And I think it can work. I believe the citizen involvement at every level is the only way our governments can continue to survive. I believe our urban communities are in desperate need of vital, energetic people who are not afraid to tackle the seemingly overwhelming problems of our cities. And thank God for the College of Urban Development here in Michigan State. I wish there were 1,000 across the country training people here. I want to congratulate the president for having the foresight and the guts to give it this level, this status in the university. We have to train students with skills for solving urban problems. Skills. You got to have commitment and sensitivity. You got to have that, but that alone won't do it. You got to be able to translate that concern into structures. This College of Urban Development here at MSU carries out an understanding of the need for commitment to meaningful and well-thought-out social reform as well. Policy decisions. Let me stress that, by the way. I was awfully impressed with Hubert Humphrey on Thursday in a closed-door meeting with all the Democratic leadership of Congress, both houses. One of the best informed public officials in this country. The point I'm getting at is, if you have skill and commitment and sensitivity but don't know what the issues are, you still don't have the package together. And so this college, with its multidisciplinary staff, helps the mayors around this country, because we know that help is on the way somewhere, certainly from here, to help us solve the urban problems we have. It's a tremendous resource. Tremendous. We've got a couple of students from MSU in Atlanta now, one on the city side, one on the school board side. I've been told that five will be coming. No problem as long as they're from Atlanta. No problem under any circumstances. You might be interested to know, by the way, that our student internship program, I've got to believe, is the most progressive in the country. We have a prototype of the White House Fellows Program, the first ever on a local level, funded by the Carnegie Corporation, in conjunction with AU, set up through our Atlanta Urban Observatory, the research unit of my office. We now bring each year, and there are four on board now, the Atlanta Fellows. $20,000 a year, non-taxable. You must be between 25 and 35 years of age, and you work at the highest levels of city government. Two in my office who work directly with me, and one each with other commissioners. Commissioners are heads of department by my appointment. We have over 130 interns in city government, whereas when I became mayor, we had six. Now, unless we can convince citizens that our cities are worth fighting for, we're going to find ourselves confronted, I believe, with empty asphalt, concrete canyons echoing with the terror of crime and the loneliness of total alienation. The learned scholars who bemoan the death of our cities are forgetting the millions of Americans across the country, black and white, young and old, rich and poor, who will not give up on those cities. They are forgetting those of us who have poured our hopes, our dreams, our commitment, and our lives into our cities, and who would no more give them up than we throw up our hands and admit defeat in the face of any kind of problem. And that's even though we live in a nation where the urban crisis, although I dislike the use of the word crisis, did not end in the late 60s. It is alive and festering in this nation, worse now than ever was. The word crisis implies something that flares up and then goes away. It hasn't gone anywhere. We just have a president who says that the urban crisis is over. But I got news for President Ford. Anytime unemployment now escalates to the point that it has in this nation, laying off policemen while crime rates escalate, can't pick up garbage in some cities, closing down fire stations, closing down schools, if somebody thinks the urban crisis is over, They probably also believe that elephants roost in trees. The 1960s were years of change and discovery. The 1970s are years of awfully hard work and of finding a way to structure the enthusiasm and the vitality of the 60s into the new forms that will lead us into 1984, not George Orwell's nightmare visions of Big Brother and his all-pervasive eye, but with a more open, more responsive, more creative government recommitted to solving people problems with the help of all the people along every step of the way. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Mayor Jackson has agreed to take just a very few questions. If you'd like to stay another 5 minutes, he will be responsive and responsive quickly. Are there questions? Yes. Trustee Huff.
Your Honor, in your long-range plan, do you have specific programs for holding and expanding job opportunities within the city?
I understand the question. I'm just trying to think of the answer. Well, let me first of all present a disclaimer. And number one is that the government that is least able, in my opinion, to control the job question is the local government. The government that is most able to control it, in my opinion, is the federal government. And the next is the state government. But with that having been said, cities have an obligation to do what we can do. Now, my feeling is that, according to Fancher in Chicago, the biggest site location consultant in the country, when an industrialist wants to find out where to locate his or her new plant, they look at many things. They look at transportation. They look at schools. They look at the cultural life of the city. They look at water and sewer, and a number of other things as well. Number one, the cities, if we are to influence the location of labor-intensive industry in our cities, must not give up to metro-regional forms the power to control where the water and sewer goes or will go. Planning, yes. Execution, no, unless the city agrees to it. Because in the metropolitan forms, if the power to influence where the water and sewer will go is released to superimpose levels of government, that water and sewer will go out of the city, industry will go out of the city, and the majority of jobs will stay in the city. The majority of needy people will be in the city. And next, it seems to me that you've got to have a city which comprehensively creates a way of life that is far more attractive than outside the city. Cities can create incentives, except in Georgia we can't tax-wise, because we have an antiquated state law which prohibits that. So South Carolina, next to us, gets a $200 million Michelin tire plant from France. And since West became governor of South Carolina and revolutionized the law so they'd be more attractive to industry now, they have more foreign investment in South Carolina than any state in the country. So, many things, incentives, creation of a better way of life in the city, that includes security, safety, and so forth, good schools, all of these. But most importantly, relying on the federal government to give us help, to give us policy direction, and to be responsive. We might even have to elect a mayor as president to get some of these things done. I'm serious. Not I, but a mayor might have to be elected president. Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am.
Right.
Well, first of all, the majority of housing projects are inside the city. Number two, the black population generally is not concentrated out. No, ma'am, that's not correct. If you mean the public housing population, the old public housing projects are within 1 mile of City Hall, 2 miles maybe. The newer ones are out. Perry Homes was put out there to get those folks out there. No transportation when it was built. Largest public housing project in Atlanta. Then came East Lake Meadows, 5,000 units. Never again in our city will we ever build that big a concentration, no more than 50 units any one time, and dispersed all over the city. That's a policy now. But we have 55,000 public housing tenants in Atlanta, Georgia. And I didn't see a rat. I saw an army of rats, some as long as 11 inches, not counting the tail, at a public housing project that was opened in 1971. It was poorly engineered insofar as water control was concerned, a turnkey project, by the way. We have structured 36 programs out of my visit that weekend to Bankhead Courts, a public housing project, where I lived in with a family for a weekend. 16 of those are in place now, and the remainder are ongoing and are planned. We've had great help from H.R. Crawford, Assistant Secretary of HUD, and many other people as well. Now, the public housing has been controlled by the Atlanta Housing Authority. Authority, a dangerous form of government, single purpose and special purpose authorities that expend tax dollars and whose members who make the decisions are not elected. And the Housing Authority has five members. I have only been able, the mayor by law appoints those five, but I've only been able to affect two. I would say that the situation is somewhat improved, but considering the desperation of the situation, we had one heck of a long way to go. I got on my desk on Friday the status report of where we are on this project, and within 2 weeks we're moving to another level entirely on the whole public housing question in the city, which I will not announce at this time. Yes, ma'am.
You mentioned an increase in the number of community groups into two houses and also an increase in the influx of whites, and I was wondering if
there are far more middle-income whites, younger, better educated, one or two kids, if any children at all, moving back into the old houses, rehabbing them. They have become vital parts of the community organizations, but the community organizations are black and white. There's a Grant Park group, by the way, whose constituency is probably 60% white, whose president is black, young black guy. One of the difficulties is a pragmatic one, and that is it's more difficult to get middle-income blacks to move back into old neighborhoods than it is to get middle-income whites to move back into old neighborhoods. That's a fact. It can be changed, the question of perception, that's all. But I'd say it's the movement, the neighborhood movement, is 70% white and 30% black. Yes, sir.
During the 1960s, many Northerners moved south to encourage the desegregation of schools. Now that you have the successful models and the hypocrisy has been exposed. Do you see Southerners coming north to desegregate northern schools?
No, I don't. We're still trying to desegregate southern schools. Now, what we don't have is as much, in my opinion, as much acute hostility as you find in many northern cities. Now, I'm not going to speculate as to all the reasons. Segregation was rigid in the South. But within that rigidity, there was more interpersonal contact, although on a very unethical level, in my opinion. That of superior to inferior, at least as that was seen by the oppressor. Wrong way to interrelate, but still, some touching, you know, some being together. They say in the South that whites didn't care how close blacks got as long as blacks didn't get up too high. And in the North, whites didn't care how high up blacks got as long as blacks didn't get too close. Now, if there's any truth to that, that could account for the greater capacity in the South, at least, to see each other someday just as people. But our school system is 85% black, the students. We have some busing, not a whole lot. We bus around 2,600 students. Couldn't bus a lot more than that because not enough white kids to go around. I'm not trying to be facetious. That's the truth. So I got kicked out of the NAACP because I supported the Atlanta plan. We sat down in Atlanta and said, here's a plan we can, I mean, months of work went into it. The black community constructed it. So we got to have some pairing of schools, some school busing. National NAACP said, bus 26,000. We said, it won't work. You know, how are you going to make it work? Show us. We came down, we had sessions galore over the course of months and months. We said we can successfully bus 2,600 students and have pairing over here and have an M2M program, minority to majority transfer. Any kid can go to any school in the city so long as the kid transfers into a school where his or her race is in the minority. So we have a multi-faceted plan. National NAACP said, no deal. You got to bus 26,000 students. Atlanta branch NAACP said, no deal. This is our plan. We stick with it. They said, okay, you're off. We're all excommunicated. I even stopped paying on my life membership. I'm going to pay on it again, of course. We have survived the peak of the moment. P-I-Q-U-E in this case, is that the way you spell it? So we have problems there, but I think the capacity, I think the South is going to lead the nation, by the way, without question, in the area of race relations. For whatever progress we can make in America, and I think we can make some, a lot, depending on how strong we're going to be, how much we understand the power relationships and their changes. But I think the South is going to lead the nation. And I thank you very much for having me.
Just a half second. Give me just a half second before you leave. Just a half second. Mayor Brookover, would you please come forth? Mayor Wilbur Brookover.
Thank you, Bob. I wouldn't want this occasion to end without my saying welcome and thanks to Mayor Jackson from Atlanta. I think you all understand from his eloquence how he was able in Houston a few months ago to turn around the conference, the National League of Cities, and get them to vote favorably on gun control legislation. I think he did it almost single-handed. It's a great pleasure to welcome you and to give you a slight token of our appreciation, Mr. Jackson.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.
is Representative Jackie Vaughn here, and this will be the last presentation. Representative Jackie Vaughn, please come forth. And while he's coming up, Councilman John Palumski, please stand. I missed you over there. Let's give him a hand, too. From East Lansing.
I'd like to, on behalf of the Michigan Legislature, my two colleagues that are here, Lynn John Dahl and Senator Nelson, and all the other co-signers, the highest tribute that we can give any city citizen is our House and Senate resolution. We pass this in the Michigan House because we support the university and it's what it is trying to do. We support the center for its effort in bringing about some of the greatest speakers in our country. I will not take time to read it because of the lateness of the hour, but Mayor Jackson, on behalf of the people of the state of Michigan, we'd like to present this resolution from our state to you for your effort and all the things that you've done to make this a better world. Thank you so much for coming to Michigan.
Thank you very much. You're very kind.
And I would like to thank all of you for coming. Have a good day.